Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the January 9th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show that airs the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, a board member, and agent liaison for Pitch Wars and a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description down there so you don't miss a show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below as well. Hey, Jay. Hey, Laura. Hi, Pubbers. Thank you all for joining us tonight. So today is a bit of a special episode. So we're going to be doing things a little bit differently from what you might be used to. I'll be handling the news portion solo, and we have just a few items before we move on to the interview portion so we can get to our guests quicker because we have a whole panel today. So I did want to mention the viewer poll. If you haven't yet voted in it, make sure you go vote in it now. And the question is pretty simple. It's, do you reread books? And this came up from a conversation with a friend last week. So we'll see how that goes. Hi, Karen. Hey, Lodestar. Hi, Heather. Welcome. Thank y'all for coming. All right. So we're going to start off with some good news, which is in short supply recently. American print book sales rose 8.2% in 2020 over Lodestar, you made me laugh. News reporter Sarah. Okay. In 2020 over 2019 numbers, with online sales offsetting declines at physical retailers. So obviously a lot more books were sold online, even though fewer books were sold at bookstores. The big increases came in both juvenile and YA, both nonfiction and fiction. Libraries also saw an uptick in the usage of their digital offerings. Overdrive reported a 40% increase in library ebooks borrowed in 2020, with again the biggest increases being in children's and YA books at a whopping 79% increase, which, wow. This is a good time to remind you that all the news items we're going to be talking about after the show, I'll have a link to the articles so that you can read more about them if you want. And so there's a lot more statistics being offered in those two articles. So if you're interested in checking that out, make sure you look at that after the show. In addition to everything else happening this week, by the way, I poured boiling water on my hand earlier this week. So if you see my hand swollen, that's what's going on. I keep catching glimpses of it when I push my glasses up. All right. In the wake of the news about Book Expo closing, which we talked about a couple episodes ago, Publishers Weekly announced the launch of the U.S. Book Show, a new American publishing trade fair that's going to debut virtually in May. They aim to make the event inclusive as possible, these are their words, with reasonable pricing and a new proprietary digital platform. And so we were all talking about when Book Expo closed, what's going to replace it, what's going on. And so this is one of the first big moves that we've seen in that direction. Yes, Lodestar. People like to say YA is dead. the 79 increase is both children's, juvenile fiction, and YA. But yeah, there are big bumps in YA during the pandemic, especially in ebooks. Jay, buying 79% more than before. Nice. Thanks, guys. Yeah. It doesn't hurt that much. It's just a giant blister right now. So it's great. All right. We just have two more news items. So actually, we're going to probably get to the guests within the next couple of minutes. So just a heads up to y'all waiting in the wings. You're going to have less time than previously thought. So following the armed insurrection of the nation's capital on Wednesday, Simon & Schuster has canceled publication of Senator Josh Hawley's book, originally scheduled to come out in June. Hawley was the first senator to object to the presidential election results, and many believe his rhetoric helped inspire the events that happened on Wednesday. And of course, this prompted yet another discussion that we always seem to have about what exactly is protected under First Amendment rights. And coincidentally, it is not people paying you to write a book. That actually is not covered. So, yay. All right. And I made sure to finish with some good news. I'm excited about this. Hopefully some other people are excited about this. Inkyard Press, an imprint of Harlequin, has announced a new line of middle grade books focusing on action-driven novels. That's going to start coming out in 2022. So more YA is great. More publishers publishing YA means more variety. And I love that. All right. That's all the news. I told you I was going to make it quick this week. So cool. Now I'm going to bring on our special guests. We have five guests today. And the first one is actually a middle grade author. So that's funny. that worked out perfectly. AJ Sass is the author of the middle grade LGBTQ plus contemporary Anna on the Edge from Little Brown Books for Young Readers, which released in October. So I'm going to bring AJ on the screen. Hello. Hi. Yeah, show everyone your book. Awesome. Hi. All right. And next up is, let me change this layout here because it's going to look, always looks weird with three people and it bothers me. Karen Osborne is the author of the space opera Architects of Memory, which came out in September from Tor Books. And Karen's book was actually pushed back 2 weeks due to some printing distribution issues.
Yeah, printing.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Lindsay. All right. And next up, next up we have David Heska. Wombly Wyden is the author of the Native American crime thriller Winter Counts, which came out in August from Echo. Hi, David.
Hey, everybody.
How are you doing?
Great.
And David was actually, he's probably the person I know the least well on the panel today, but he was recommended to me by Kelly Garrett, who we all know and love on this show. So I'm excited to talk to him. All right. And Meryl Wolzner is the author of the romance Something to Talk About from Berkeley, which released in May. Yay. Hello.
Hi.
And last but not least, we're in Jesco. I just scrolled past you the first time. Okay. Jess Hernandez is the author of First Day of Unicorn School, a picture book that released last week from Capstone Editions. Yeah.
Hi.
So congratulations. That's a hell of a launch week.
Yes.
All right. And everyone in the comments is saying hi to y'all. So if you see people saying hi, pubbers, my regulars on the channel have kind of like named themselves pubbers last year, or actually it was 2 years ago now. Whoa. so that's kind of like the regulars that watch the show. So hello, pubbers. Thank you all for showing up all the time. Jay said First Day of Unicorn School looks so damn adorable.
It really is. Mariana Applebaum did such a fantastic job with the illustrations. I love them.
Cool. All right. So we're going to go ahead and get started with the question. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think all of you were kind of around publishing for a while before you published, had friends who were authors and all that. So you kind of knew what to expect from your debut year. Or you thought you did. So how did your reality differ from your expectations, and how much of that was due to the pandemic? We can just go. Anyone who wants to start, feel free to jump in.
I'll go. My mom says that people in my family are put on this earth to speak first when there's an awkward silence. So I can handle that.
Thank you.
I think, honestly, I'm not sure I did know what to expect from, you know, debut year. The main thing that I learned from authors who I knew was that I got a therapist like as soon as possible, because I knew that I was going to need that to get through debut year. And I did, and I'm very grateful that I did that. But as for like, I don't know, I guess sort of the nitty gritty of it, I don't think I knew. I still kind of feel like I don't know what I'm doing. Like I'm just flying by the seat of my pants. And obviously it was, of course, very different. I debuted in May, and obviously like nothing was happening in person. My book got picked as a Indie Next and a Library Reads pick, which was really great, but like nobody was going to stores or libraries in person. So, you know, that sort of was, you know, great, but then a letdown in that way. So, and I think there were sort of a lot of things like that for debut year of things that were still really exciting, but then sort of disappointing because you couldn't do anything in person. You couldn't, you know, meet readers in person and anything like that. So that was pretty tough for me.
Well, it was kind of similar to what I went through actually. Like I feel very new to publishing still. I was a Pitch Wars mentor in 2019, and I co-mentored with a 2019 debut named Nicole Mellaby. So I sort of watched Nicole's debut, which was an in-person event where she lived. And because my event or my book is very figure skating centric, I kind of got the idea in my head that I would have my launch party at an ice rink with all of my local friends and stuff. So, but obviously that didn't happen because the rink was shut down for most of 2020. So the lucky thing, I guess, for me was that because I debuted in October, I kind of saw it coming. I think like in the early days of the pandemic, we thought, well, maybe this will only last like a month or two. Even my agent was like, well, don't totally write off having an in-person event. You might be able to have it. But by August, she was like, yeah, we need to pivot. So, I mean, like everything was virtual at that point. So it wasn't a shock. But, and I don't even think I was too super disappointed that I couldn't necessarily have that in-person event, because what actually happened with the virtual event was really wonderful. But yeah, maybe next year when the paperback comes out, or I don't know, maybe I'll write another skating book someday.
Mm. I'll jump in. Well, for me, the pivot, I think, AJ, I very much had to pivot as well. I had a whole schedule blocked out. I was supposed to go to Book Expo. I had, you know, I had a tour set up. And then, of course, I debuted in August. And so by that point, you know, we knew that everything was canceled and it sucked. So I pivoted to an essay strategy. So I published an essay in the New York Times, and that seemed to get the ball rolling for me. So once the New York Times essay was published, then I started getting picked up by a number of lists and all that. And then Book of the Month Club chose it as a main selection. But every single one of my events was canceled, and I was pretty devastated. And for me, the lack of a launch party still stings. Anyway, that's what I got.
I was not told that I need a therapist. I know now. So if there are any writers who, you know, are considering, you know, becoming an author and being, you know, and having a debut year, get a therapist. You're going to need it. It's not that bad. It's not that bad.
Everyone should have a therapist. You go through a lot of
it's an emotional roller coaster, because you put so much of yourself into this book and this venture and those pages, and it can be like 5-10 years of your life, and then it happens, and then what? And then you have to figure out what comes next. And that's hard enough in a year where you're not, you know, running away from the coronavirus and you know, all the other things that happened this year. I know, like David, I was very sad to lose my in like live launch party. Here in Baltimore, we had a slew of really awesome debut authors have their debuts in like the 6 to 10 months, and I got to go to all of those parties, and you know, and when it came around to mine, I had this wonderful launch party with the Ivy Bookstore, and I pressed leave room, and I was alone in this office, which I'm in all the time. And it was a very interesting experience. It was different and disappointing in a way, but also kind of I mean, who else is going to get to have this kind of experience? So we're special in a way. I like to tell myself.
Jess, you had the most kind of warning out of everyone.
I did. Actually, my book got moved up. Oh. I was originally scheduled to publish in March. And then in the middle of the summer, my editors switched because my original editor left and my new editor is like, hey, your pub date is now January 1st. And I was like, what? I thought I had 9 months to prepare, and suddenly I only had 6, and that was very stressful and terrifying. So I'm very glad that other people like y'all got to do it first so I could pick your brains. And I did a lot of that. Trying to figure out, okay, well, what does this mean for me? Because when the pandemic hit, I sort of figured it would be a long time. I really hoped it would be over by March of next year, but because I'd had this beautiful dream of having a launch party at my local library where I used to work, and having unicorn cookies and photo gallery, all my friends bring their kids, and yeah, that didn't happen. I mean, I think I'll probably try something like that again in the fall, since my book is a going back to school book. If it's safe, we'll see if I can, have a round two. But I honestly didn't do anything for my launch day. I figured, it's a holiday. A lot of people are hungover anyway, and no one's going to the library. So a lot of places were closed. So we just, I announced it on Twitter, and then we went to the lake. So that was my day.
Okay. Wow. I feel like y'all were talking, I feel like whenever we can have in-person events, every debut should adopt a pandemic debut, and you can have a joint debut party. That'll be fun. If you have your friends, tell them I said so. There was something. Okay. So Jay's trying to start trouble. So we have this kind of ongoing debate with my regular viewers, coffee versus tea. So they were asking Meryl if they had coffee or tea.
It's just water. Sorry to let you down.
So you're not going to choose a side.
I am not taking a side.
It's mainly they're mocking me because I don't like tea and they all like tea. So, all right. So we have a question from a Patreon supporter, Lodestar. So if you support at $5 a month or more, you can submit questions ahead of time for the shows. So Lodestar asks, do you think there are some difficulties in publishing that the pandemic actually helped with, things like communication, collaboration, or something else?
I have been having a blast putting together a series of events for the sequel to Architects of Memory, which is Engines of Oblivion, out on February 9th. So 1 month from now. Pre-orders are love. Sorry, I had to. I had to. But I'm talking with all of these writers who are not from Baltimore. People I've met at conferences, people I've met when I'm traveling, and people I wouldn't normally get to have an event with. So I get to have I'm going to get to have some really nice conversations with people that don't live here. And I think that is one thing that I'm actually looking forward to that the pandemic did. Now that people are so much more used to going onto YouTube and Zoom and et al. To have those events that we get to do that, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I totally agree. Sorry, go ahead, Jess.
I was just gonna piggyback on that. So I'm a mom of 3 kids that are small, and my husband works 2 jobs, and I live in a teeny tiny town in the middle of nowhere. So I have really loved this shift to online everything, because I actually get to participate in stuff finally. I can go to conferences because, just shut the door. I don't have to buy tickets to anywhere and find a babysitter for my 3 little hellions. So I like that part.
Salute from another toddler mom.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, basically. I mean, I thought about doing sort of a little mini tour on my own because I'm not originally from the West Coast. My family lives all over the East Coast and in the South and in the Midwest. So I thought I'd kind of crash all over the place. But if the pandemic hadn't happened, I would have had my in-person event and virtually none of my family would have been able to come. So the fact that it was all virtual meant that they got to celebrate with me. Like, I think it was Karen said it was a little weird to say goodbye and shut off my screen and then be like, oh, I'm alone in this house with cupcakes my friends send me, but then no one else is here. But also, at least for middle grade and YA, I'm sure picture book and adult debuts have something similar, but we had this debut group on Facebook that I know previous debut classes have also had, but the fact that we couldn't meet each other at BookCon or any of the other conferences, I think meant that we really had the opportunity to get to know each other better and to talk about launching events. There were a bunch of new events that came out specifically because of the pandemic, like Everywhere Book Fest, I think it was called, and Middle Ground Book Fest, which was specifically for middle grade writers. And I feel like I got to know a lot of my debut class more than I would have necessarily if I hadn't, you know, been forced to do this virtually, kind of everyone. And then also on a personal note, I have some accessibility issues. I'm autistic, so some of the larger conferences might be too difficult for me to handle in terms of sensory overwhelm and stuff. So the fact that I can control my own environment and still participate in virtual events like this has been kind of a blessing in disguise.
Hmm. Well, I'll chime in. And just say that, yeah, everybody's experience here is kind of mirroring mine. You know, I'll just say one thing. My last sort of boohoo of the night, my book came out 2 days ago in France. And I was supposed to get a full tour before the pandemic. My friend was supposed to fly me over, give me a translator. I've never been to France, okay? I'm American Indian. I come from a fairly impoverished background. I've been out of the country like twice. This was like my big time, you know, to see France and not be intimidated and all that. And so boo-hoo for me. But having they did a great job with the book from what I hear. You know, for me, I would say what the pandemic helped with was certainly events, just like what everybody else has said here. You know, I think I counted them up. I did 51 events. I'm pretty sure that I would not have done that many had there not been a pandemic. So I got to really, and I'm counting book clubs in there. I met with about 2 or 3 dozen book clubs. I'm still getting calls weekly to meet with book clubs. I've got one in a couple of days. So I think, you know, the idea here is that, you know, I've really been able to connect with the readers in a much better way. So if any silver lining to come out of this, I would say it's that.
I cannot imagine doing 51 events. I got exhausted and I did not do anything close to 51 events. So I'm very impressed. And I do think it's completely fair to boo-hoo over missing France.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I kind of wish that we had somebody here who had debuted in like March. Didn't have sort of the preparation time. Because I only had one event that had already been scheduled that was supposed to be in person. We sort of hadn't gotten everything figured out yet. I guess I had 2 events that were supposed to be in person. We hadn't gotten it all figured out yet. So I didn't have as much like, oh, this got canceled, I can't do this, which I think, you know, in a March or April debut, obviously would really have that. But yeah, same as everybody else, you know, it's been great to my debut week. I did an event every night and I did an event with someone from Alabama. I live in Michigan. So someone from Alabama, someone from New York, a panel with people everywhere, and another Michigan author. So I would never have been able to, you know, have those conversations with those people. And that's been really great. But what for me has been, or I think was at least the sort of the most helpful and encouraging thing about the pandemic that made it very different this year is that I think it's really easy for authors to be like, this is my debut, everything has to go right. You know, this is my only chance. This is all I hope that none of you sort of felt that way, because we have all been able to be like, well, I can have my launch party next time. You know, like it made me focus more on, I think, longevity, I guess, and what I'm going to do next. And, you know, oh, next time I want, you know, cupcake shaped like unicorns or whatever at my launch party. Like to have a better idea of what you can do later, rather than just focusing on right now. Because I, at least, you know, I want a long career in publishing. So that was helpful for me.
Y'all are also positive. I love it. I am not a positive person, so I need to surround myself with them. I love that AJ mentioned Everywhere Book Fest because I was actually the lead video producer for Everywhere Book Fest.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun. There was a draw with some like picture book artists with Raoul III. I remember who else was on it, but that was like one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. It was so fun. I got to produce that one. All right. So, Ebony has a question. How has the pandemic made you look at reading or writing differently? Or I guess also let's expand that too and see, has it changed kind of your writing habits and your writing life? Yes.
Oh my. So I'm going to jump in first again. I'm the mom of a toddler. She's 17 months old. And my husband and I work at home. So I love what Meryl said about concentrating on longevity, because before this I was like, oh, especially in science fiction, you're just really, you know, you're really like, I have to do this. I have to be good. And of course I'm competitive and I'm, you know, and I'm perfectionist and I love to do everything, you know, really, really well and really, really right. So, but it's kind of made me, not concentrate so much on, writing, but like making writing more of not the thing I do most, but the thing that is included in the rest of my day, the thing that is included and folded into my life. I don't do balance. I just don't. I go like a Mack truck down the highway. But the pandemic has required me to seek balance, to seek that sort of push towards longevity. To be honest, without it, I don't know if I would be doing this, and it's been wonderful for me. So but without the pandemic I might, you know, God knows.
I think for me it's forced me to like treat this as the career that it is. Like I have to like schedule time for myself now because I have two kids on Zoom school every day, and I have to figure out how to make that work, and a toddler who's into everything. So like I have to schedule with my partner, okay, when are we gonna let me do the things that I have to do to, you know, send the emails or write the next book or whatever. And so like it's forced me to become a lot more professional, a lot more intentional with my time and the way that I approach writing, I think.
Yeah, I think intentional is a good word. I think it's made me become more intentional as well with my writing. And for me, that is actually sort of allowing myself to write less. I think pre-debut and pre-pandemic, I was, you know, very much like, okay, I got to write this much per day, or like, this is my goal. And I was always shooting for that. And I had sort of spreadsheets tracking how many words per day and things like that. I recognize that, you know, maybe that is sustainable in a year that's not 2020, but it wasn't for that time. So I've learned to be sort of very gentle with myself. And if, you know, I'm unable to get something out one day, I can do it the next day. But it does make me more intentional with the time that I do write. You know, so I may write less often or I may write fewer words, but I think that I've put more into what I am. When I am actually writing, I'm able to put more into it, because it's not just, oh, hey, you know, let's go to a coffee shop and write. Like, that's not an option. which is sort of what I would do basically for fun pre-pandemic. So it's definitely made me more intentional in that way.
I miss coffee shops
so much.
I was in one today. It was great. First one, we just opened up a little bit here. I'm in Denver, Colorado. And it was like, oh, I've missed you, coffee shops. I've missed you. So, you know, what nobody has mentioned so far about the pandemic is my concentration got destroyed by the pandemic. In fact, I published an article, I don't know, a month or two ago in A Year in Reading. There's a series on the Millions website. And if you want to read about my year in reading, you can read about the books that I tried to read in 2020. My concentration got completely destroyed. I finally pulled it together. Oh, and P.S., in that article, I also talk about the time that I got Zoom bombed by an 80-year-old man completely naked masturbating on screen.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my goodness. So,
that was probably the low point of the year for me. You know, it was hard to keep reading after seeing that image, which is unfortunately seared upon my brain. Anyway, reading was just destroyed for me. Writing, I'm still just trying to come out of this promotional blitz. You know, it's been 4 months of, you know, I've done like 25 to 30 interviews. They're starting to slow down, thank goodness. So yeah, I'm eager to get back into reading and writing again.
Yeah, I'm glad. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add on to that. Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's just this year in particular, but I was unprepared for the amount of clerical work that goes with the debut. Just the number of interviews and emails and everything. And I had not counted on that. No one warned me about that one. So that was a surprise. And the lack of concentration, I think, made that even harder. So.
Totally agree. And I'm really glad Dave mentioned the lack of concentration in terms of reading habits, because I was once a voracious reader and then March hit and I don't know why this happened. Maybe it was a concentration thing, but I'm this person with my library where I'll put a ton of things on hold and then you can, I think, postpone getting them for a little while, but only for a certain date. And I totally forgot the date that I was going to push them out even further. And I ended up with like 50 books arriving at once. And my partner had said, you know, you don't have to go pick those up. But I was like, no, I do. You don't understand. It's the reader in me. But like, I couldn't read like I used to be able to. Like even YA and middle grade, the paragraphs felt too dense to me. And what was interesting is right before everything in the Bay Area shut down, I attended an event from a March debut, Kate O'Shaughnessy, who wrote this really beautiful middle grade contemporary called The Lonely Heart of Maybelle Lane. And she was in conversation with another author, Amy Lucido, who debuted the year before. And Amy was also selling her book at the event. And it was a novel in verse, which I'd never read before, mostly because as a teenager, I had really hated poetry. And that's kind of what I associated with. But I ended up buying both of the books. And I picked up Amy's book, which is called Emmy and the Key of Code, another middle grade, in mid-March after everything had shut down, and started reading it. And there was something about the fact that there was so much white space on the page and I could get through pages faster, that I was really engaging with the material a lot more than I had in a really long time. So I started reading a lot of novels in verse just because I felt like it was making me productive and I was kind of absorbing books in a different way than I had before the pandemic. In terms of my writing stuff, I feel like everyone was like, be gentle with themselves. And that's what I should have done, but it was not what I did for most of last year. I sold my second book on proposal, which is about 50 pages of the full manuscript and a synopsis. And my editor, once she bought it, called and, you know, gushed about it, but then said, so can you get the rest of this written in a month? And
I should have
pushed back a little bit, but I was like, sure, why not? You know, like it's middle grade. It's not that long, except when I overwrite something and make it, you know, like 30% longer than it needs to be. So this was kind of the year where I felt like I almost killed myself trying to get this done, and it just didn't happen in that 30 days. And luckily my agent's very wonderful and an advocate, but I didn't even want to come to her to let her know I was struggling with writing it in terms of concentrating and just getting what I needed to get done on the page. Because the year before I'd been revising my debut and that had been really intense too, but you know, a couple of really late nights and I had gotten it in on time. So I thought I could do the same here, and it really wasn't the case. So it took, I asked for like a 2-week extension and sent in something that I'm really embarrassed to admit I sent into my editor, because it wasn't even at the point where I wanted to share it with critique partners at the time. But I also learned, you know, my editor also had some problems getting me feedback in terms of concentration and doing creative work. And then when she finally did get my edit letter to me, I also needed another extension on that. So while my debut didn't end up getting bumped or anything, my second book is actually coming out about 5 months after what we'd initially planned, just to give ourselves more time. So I agree with everyone else to be gentle with yourself. I just wish I had been a little better at it. But I feel like the last year has kind of taught me that it's okay to ask for more time. And I think everyone is kind of understanding about that with respect to, it's been a hard year, basically, for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I also want to talk about, like, in terms of reading and concentration, that not only is it hard for me to sit down and like make the decision to read, I almost feel like I've been putting some books off because I'm excited about them and I want to still have that excitement to hold on to. Like, that's a good thing to have in a year that sometimes doesn't feel great. So like I have a couple of my friends' books, and including one that's not out yet, that I'm like, I am so excited to read. And I, you know, if I were putting it to you in not literal terms, I would say I can't wait to read them, but I have them and I'm not reading them. So clearly I can wait. But I do think that part of it is just that holding on to the joy of oh, I'm gonna get to read this soon, even though I could have the joy of reading it. I don't know. It's just it helps to just have that. I really like having it. And so yeah, my reading has, numbers have definitely plummeted in terms of how many books I read last year.
That's so cool that you use them as like a carrot, I guess, for yourself in the future.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to read them. And I'm just not doing it. I don't know why, but.
No, my reading habits changed a lot. Instead of novels and verse like AJ, I turned to graphic novels and read a holy ton of graphic novels because that's what I could handle. And like for a while, yeah, I was the one that was returning like all the books I read too. But it's sad because I love like the really important meaty issue books, and like I love supporting those because I feel like they are so necessary a lot of times. And like, but I just couldn't do it this year because there was so much other heavy stuff going on that I just couldn't pour more of it into my brain. So yeah, I graphic novels and romance, that's where I was this year.
I've seen a lot of discussion in media about, in media that covers media, people are going like two different ways. Like they're either only looking at like light, fluffy, like happy things, only reading, watching, whatever. And then there are the other people who are like going way dark because they're like, well, this is worse than what we have. So it makes me feel better, I guess.
Yeah. After I had my romance period, then I hit like all the horror books in the fall. So it was like very, very two-dimensional there, either really dark or really fluffy.
AJ, we've had two comments now about your bookshelf.
That was also a pandemic project.
I wanted to make a comment on it too, which I was leaning in. Do you have Late to the Party by Kelly Quinlan in your yellows or no? I couldn't tell.
I think I might. Yeah, it's that might be one of my favorite reads. I'm excited to read and haven't read yet. But
that's one that I like finished at like 1 a.m. and yelled on Twitter for a while and then was like, nobody's awake. I'll just do this when I wake up, and woke up the next day and then yelled some more about it in the morning.
So maybe that's one I shouldn't put off as much, but I'm kind of the same way as you in the last question where I was like, I want to read this when I'm in the right headspace too, so I can get really excited about it.
All right. So David obviously did a lot of events, virtual events, and Meryl mentioned you did a couple too. Do you feel like those affected your book sales, or do you have any input on that? That's the way a lot of people are like, I don't know.
I have some thoughts on what affects book sales. So I got reviewed in the New York Times, and if you get reviewed in the Times, I noticed an immediate, obviously, uptick in sales, you know, in the Amazon ranking. and LA Times affected it. So what I noticed most was that the big periodicals, a review there obviously helps you. As far as the Zoom events, I don't know that they really helped my sales, but I think obviously they really help with reader engagement. I am new to Instagram. I've been on about 6 months. I absolutely love it. I have just this devoted fan base. They love to take pictures of my book. And so that is the thrill and the nicest part of all this. Every day I wake up and there are like three or four cool pictures of my book. And I think that was where the Zoom engagement really helped. That's just my experience.
Yeah, I think that virtual events sort of, for me anyway, they gave me an opportunity to yell about my book on social media, which is something, you know, obviously I could have done whenever, but it's hard to do, I think, a lot. It's hard to sort of be like, oh, I'm annoying these people by talking about my book again. So I appreciated virtual events for that. I think it gave me an opportunity to sort of be like, oh, let me come back into people's minds and talk about my book again. But like David said, there are sort of, I think, definitely bigger things. Something to talk about, made a couple year-end lists recently. And that definitely, you know, drove it up. It was on, I think, NPR's list in New York Public Library for like best books of 2020. And that I could see sales go up on. But as for virtual events, really, who knows? But they were still fun to do. And like David said too, for reader engagement, like I only did a couple of book clubs, but those are my favorite ones. I didn't feel as pressured for one because I knew it was just, you know, sort of, I don't know, I wasn't talking to anybody who I was like, I'm not cool enough to be on this panel, you know, like that sort of thing. It was just like, oh, just talking to readers. And I always thought those were my favorite events.
So I don't know any of my book sales numbers yet, I think, but specific to middle grade and possibly also picture book, as I understand it, a lot of the push with my publisher goes into school and library, which does not necessarily show up on something like BookScan, where you'd be looking at sales that go into bookstores. So my agent has basically said, well, we'll wait until your first royalty statement, and then we'll see if you got any sales into school and libraries and stuff. So I'm not sure if any of the events that I did actually drove sales one way or the other. I know I got a little bit, I think I got like 800 new Twitter followers or something after I published an op-ed in Time Magazine, which directly related to, or the Time Online version, which related to J.K. Rowling's comments about trans people. But that was before my book came out, so I'm not sure if that helped with pre-orders or anything like that. And Zoom events, I think, like others have said, are more to just engage with readers. I do think one that was helpful for me, or potentially helpful for me, was being on a panel with other trans and non-binary authors for NCTE, which is the National Conference of Teachers of English, which is mostly just for educators and stuff. And it seems like a fairly big event. And there were other larger names on there, like Kaysen Callender, who recently won the National Book Award. So I think that one was really great and kind of gave me the opportunity to talk about my book among people who already were kind of set to want to support books like mine. But in terms of actual numbers, I unfortunately don't know anything.
Yeah, you don't really get to know the numbers. And I know my agent has been very clear with me that the numbers don't even matter really right after your debut. So you're not really going to even know how you're doing. And I put that in quotes because it also depends on a lot of other things that are different for every single author. So my approach to book sales through the whole process has basically been to ignore them. And to focus on the things that make me happy, the things that drive engagement with readers. Because, I mean, I feel like you're not going to know. I feel like it's just going to stress you out, especially for my personality. It definitely would. So I kind of just went, okay. I'm just going to, this is going to be my thing. I enough is bothering me during the pandemic. I don't really need to know. I just need to do the things that make me as a writer happy and that make me able to write the next book.
Nice. Yeah, I think being in picture books, it's a very different dynamic because, I mean, your readers are never going to buy your book exactly. So I've had to, you know, more appeal to parents than anything else, especially since right now libraries are not buying as many physical copies, especially of picture books, and they're not buying as many copies at schools either, because they've got all the pandemic gear to buy and the money has to come from somewhere. So yeah, so I think over the years, my brand has been kind of like Disaster Mom, which has ended up being a really great thing for me as far as selling this book, because like I've already got that base of like parents that I interact with online. And so that ended up being a really good thing for me. But as far as like online, like Zoom events and things, I've done some school visits, which have been super fun. But it's more just for kicks and giggles and for, you know, a chance to see the readers that I'm working with. And they're really rewarding it emotionally. Like I love meeting the kids and like having them be like, oh my gosh, look at those pictures. You're an author. How old are you? So, you know, that's fun. But, you know, I really doubt that it's going to drive sales anywhere. So,
yeah. It's interesting because I've gone to a lot of virtual events, but I find myself going to only to the events where I'm already a fan of the author. I already know the author. But I did host an event for the library with Frederick Bachman, and he was like so funny that I was like, I have to go get his book, because that's like not a genre that I would normally pick up, you know, but I just thought he was like hilarious. So so there was one. We know for sure what virtual event caused one book sale this year. All right, so we kind of have a fun question from Patreon supporter Lodestar again. By the way, Lodestar, none of the authors write under a pen name, so I can't ask your other question. But his question was, what is the most fun or interesting thing you did for promotion? And bless him, he added outside of this event.
I know, I'll go.
Go for it.
So I don't know who she is, but I got to know her. Her name is Kara Brown, and she has a book club. I think she's out on the West Coast. She's an influencer or something. And so she chose me for her, September book club. And so we did an event with the Native American comedian, Joey Clift. He is like the funniest guy I've ever known in my life. And so if you don't know Joey Clift, trust me, he's hilarious on Twitter, and he's got some TV shows coming out and everything. And so we just got on and we talked for an hour, and with somebody who actually makes their living making people laugh, that was absolutely like one of my favorite moments of the year.
Nice.
So I did a lot of kind of video promo, like amateur video making, not quite TikTok level awesome, because I don't even have a TikTok. I barely have a TikTok, but yeah. So what I did is I'm actually a figure skater myself, and I am pretty tapped into the adult skater community since I'm an adult right now. So on Facebook, I just kind of asked people if anyone would be willing to send me videos of their figure skating fails. And I got a surprising amount of people who are willing to do this, even after I said I'm sharing this publicly on Twitter and stuff. And I kind of knit them all together with a backdrop of this ice dance music called the Killian. It's like a march with like trombones and stuff, so I could hit their falls right on the brass beats and everything. And I also, our rinks open up around that same time, so I brought my hardcover book to the rink and had a couple of people film me doing like little jumps and stuff with it. And I had been off the ice for like 4 or 5 months, so my jumps weren't that good, but I kind of filmed those two, and I was like, well, that's a fail and stuff. But, and I superimposed my voice on it, just kind of talking about the parallels between training and figure skating and drafting a novel, because to me, they're very similar, and how you start off not being very good at anything and build up over time. So I pieced that together and shared it, and people seemed to like it, and that was a lot of fun for me.
Can I say two things? Because there are two things. first one is very short. My book takes place in and around a planet in space, in a spaceship with people who live and work in space. And I was able to talk with a book club of NASA rocket scientists, actual NASA engineers that send the rockets up, that know how to live and work in space. And that was just the geekiest, most wonderful thing I did. I spent the whole time answering questions going, but I want to talk to you guys about how this works. It was really, really, really a lot of fun. The other thing was I did some video too. I used to be a video producer for a living at a library.
At my library.
Yeah, at her library. It was the best job I ever had. Best job besides this one. And I was a wedding videographer. So on the run up to the launch party, I was like, well, why not make promo videos for the corporation in my book? So I made a whole bunch of promo videos for Aurora Intergalactic, which is the company in my book. And I kept on, I got to use a lot of, there's actually a lot of space-based stock footage, if you can believe it. I didn't know that. Now I do. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. I actually, at my launch party, I pretended to be the onboarding person, taking everyone into the company and giving them all the information about what it was like to work for the company. And this is HR. And I just nerded out the whole time. And it's not online because I still have to actually pay the license fee, but it will be online sometime in the next couple of weeks, hopefully. So
cool. I also have two. And to be honest, I don't think either of them really helped that much with, you know, promotion or like, but they were, these are the two sort of fun things, like the most fun things that I did. And one of them is a bookstore nearby, but not super close to where I live, had, you know, Instagrammed about the book with a picture of it. And I reached out and was like, oh, hey, like, can I come by and sign some copies? Just sort of, cause why not? Might as well. And that was just really fun. She was so excited. And, you know, she had like, I think maybe two copies of the book in a very small bookstore. Like it wasn't, I don't think that me signing them made them like suddenly more valuable really to anybody who was, I don't think anybody was going to go to that bookstore and necessarily like, oh, well, I'll get this one just because it's signed and I wouldn't have gotten it otherwise. Like, and I don't think it was that helped, but it was just so fun and nice to just because make, you know, an independent bookstore owner like very excited and happy. She was so thrilled to meet me. And I was like, oh, I felt very fancy and important. but it was really nice. And the other one is I had a great time taking pictures of my book at any time, like even pre-pandemic when we could go to coffee shops and I had ARCs. I would arrange it with my like any coffee shop I went to, I would be like, well, I want a picture with this coffee or with, and this fall I took it. I went apple picking and I brought my book with me and I have a picture of my book in an apple tree and in like a sunflower field and things like that. And it's fun. It was really fun to me to be sort of unabashedly proud of this. And like, I mean, doing something that was sort of silly, like I wasn't like, oh God, who's going to see me taking this weird, like I put my book on a swing in a sunflower field and was like, sorry, like small child, you can go on the swing next. I got to take this video first. but it was just fun to be really unabashedly proud and happy of what I was doing and finding, you know, cool ways to take pictures with it. Which again, I don't really feel like anyone bought my book because they saw the picture of it in an apple tree. But
it was, it was fun to do. That was the one that got me.
My favorite thing so far, and granted it's only been a week, so it's not like, you know, I have a huge list to choose from, but it's not even something I've done, but people that have bought the book have reached out and sent me pictures of their kids like reading it and laughing, and that is just the best thing I've ever seen in my life. So I love that more than anything else.
That's awesome. All right, so we are almost out of time, so I'm just going to ask you all the last question, the question I ask every guest on my show. And I did give you a little bit of a heads up, so Ebony, you might not see the reaction you're used to seeing. And the question is, what is the most important book you've ever read and why? And defining important however you want to. Okay, we'll go around the circle. We'll start with AJ.
Of course. Well, I had a little bit of a heads up even without you, because I kind of watched one of your other episodes in preparation. And then, so Ebony, I'm sorry you don't get to see my reaction, but it was literally when it came up during that one, I was like, oh crap, she's going to ask that, isn't she? and I feel like my answer might change from day to day, honestly, because I kind of define importance differently depending on what I'm thinking about in my own life, especially with my own identities, being queer and autistic and Jewish. But I think one book that has always kind of stayed with me and has meant different things to me at different points in my life is The Giver by Lois Lowry. I think it was probably, I mean, to me, it's like the original dystopian. I know it's not, but that's what it felt like when I first read it in fourth grade. And I feel like it really kind of taught me empathy at a really early age, and also kind of made me think about how I want the world to be, you know, as a 10-year-old, like what do I want the world to be? And why did I view certain things in this book as unjust? And I think as I got older, it just meant more and more to me because of that. And right now I only write contemporary, but I hope to write speculative and sci-fi and stuff later on. And I just keep going back to that book, as it's very short. So if you haven't read it, it's a quick read, but it just packs so much punch in the words. And it kind of also, as a young child, it was the first book that I read that kind of had an open-ended ending where we don't know, especially if it was middle grade, which I'm not sure if it must be because it won the Newbery, right? But I feel like most middle grade, they always kind of beat into you that it needs to have a happy ending. And I'm like, I don't know if that ending was happy or not, because it ended before we found out. So it made me think on so many different levels. And I kind of feel that it's kind of also influenced me as an author too, where, you know, my book does end happily, but it doesn't end with everything tied up neatly in a bow, especially in terms of my main character's pronouns. I really didn't want this 12-year-old to have all the answers. And I feel like it kind of goes back to that book for me.
That's great. Giver is one of mine too. So I was like,
yeah.
The interesting thing for me for The Giver is, like, I think about it now as like a classic, right? Like it's one of those like standards. And I went back and I looked, and it was like literally published the year before I read it. Like it was a new book.
Yeah, like in the 90s, right?
Also, yeah.
Mid-90s. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, we always hear this debate, like it's ongoing, about like if kids should read the classics or if kids should read whatever new books. And I'm like, that was a new release then. Like, that's interesting. All right, Karen, you're up.
Yeah, The Giver. I read that when I was 14, the year it came out, I think. Mine is also a kid's book. I have a lot of books that mean a lot to me, but I think the one that means the most is The Paper Bag Princess. And it is a it is a wonderful little story. And the author's name is escaping me right now. Robert Munch. It's a Robert Munch book. Mm-hmm. And it's a book about a princess whose castle is burned down from a dragon, and her boyfriend is carried off. And so she decides to put on a paper bag and go after and rescue the boyfriend and take back what's hers. And it doesn't end in the way you think it would end. The ending is just mwah. And if you haven't read it, you just need to go out. But I have a lot of memories of reading that with my mom, and I used to read it over and over and over and over again. And that helped me, I think, put myself into a place in my life where I was like, well, I can do it. Things are hard. My castle burned down, you know, but I could still do that. And that was really important for me in middle school, because middle school was not that great for me. It's not great for anybody, but I mean, I still come back to it now. It's like when you know, something hard comes down, I think, well, at least my dragon didn't burn down my castle. Anyway, I get it for every child, every single child I know. If they don't have that book, I'm just like, here you go, right there. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful book.
Jess, we'll go with you next.
Okay. So, unlike the rest of you, I came rather late to children's books. My parents had kind of they were one of those people that pushed the classics and only the classics. And so as a result, I didn't read a lot of like middle grade or YA when I was growing up. And so for that reason, I'm gonna cheat and pick two. But so I was a middle school teacher for like 6 years. And that was my real introduction to like children's literature as it stands now. And I remember reading The Rules of Survival by Nancy Whirlen. And it's this really like gritty look at this life of a boy whose mom is super abusive and his job is basically just keeping his younger siblings alive and safe. And like, I was blown away. I was like, I didn't know you could do this in kids' books. Like you could have real important conversations about what life is really like. And like, it was the first time that I really got to see children's literature as a form of therapy for kids and a way to see themselves and a way to know that, you know, their hurts and their struggles, they're not the only ones seeing those and experiencing those. And so like that really is what turned me on to children's literature. And it was as an adult, but you know, I got there. And similarly, I didn't have a terribly high opinion of picture books growing up because it was like all Berenstain Bears. So not that there's anything wrong with Berenstain Bears, but they're kind of formulaic. But when I got to have children, I started working in a library and I started getting more of the contemporary books. And I came across Stuck by Oliver Jeffers. And it's the story of a little boy whose kite gets stuck in the tree. And he tries to get it down. And it's just this ridiculous escalation. Like he throws a shoe up, his shoe gets stuck. He throws a cat up, the cat gets stuck. He ends up throwing like a whale and a lighthouse and just like ridiculous nonsense into that tree. And it was so clever and the voice was just so wry and funny. And I was like, wow, this is really smart. I love this. I can do this. I want to do this. This is what I want to do. I want to write something this funny and this clever. So that was my other one.
All right.
I also am picking a kid's book, a newer one, not one that I read as a kid, but it's called From the Stars in the Sky to the Fish in the Sea. And I looked it up, so I knew the author's name. It's Kai Cheng Tam, and it's about a non-binary child. And when I bought it, it like wept the whole way through it. I cry easily, to be fair. But yeah, I cried the whole way through it. And now it's, you know, the book that I recommend for anyone asking for kids books, or buy if I'm buying a book for someone with a kid. But the reason that I picked it for, you know, sort of the most important is that a friend recently told me a story. She reads it to her kid a fair amount. And recently, and they sometimes will talk about gender with it. And, you know, I mean, she's five now, but she's sort of, you know, it doesn't necessarily engage with them on that. And she just recently told me a story about it where they talked about, you know, girls and boys. And my friend said, you know, well, what about non-binary kids? And her daughter was sort of more engaged with it and said, you know, oh, will I ever meet a non-binary person? And she was like, you already have, you know, mommy's friend Meryl is non-binary. And that made me really emotional because I just never sort of considered like being the first non-binary person that a child would meet. So that was, I cried then too. but just the book is just, it's lovely and it's gorgeous. It's beautifully, beautiful pictures. And so, yeah, so that's sort of my go-to. That's I just love it.
Nice.
Well, I guess I'll go last. I happened to pull it up. So this is, if you can see it with all the glare I've got here, it's Winter in the Blood by James Welch. So let me explain why this book means so much to me. So I'm a citizen of the Sichangu Lakota Nation. And as I mentioned before, I grew up in fairly rough circumstances. And the neighborhood I grew up in, we didn't even have a library within 20 miles. And so, but we had a bookmobile that came. And so the bookmobile would come every Friday. And I'm a first generation college student, you know, and so, you know, we didn't have a lot of books around my house, but I would go to the library and just get stacks and stacks of books because, like all of us here, I was a complete book nerd. And then when I was about 10 or 11, I happened to pick this one up at the bookmobile by chance. And it's the first book written, James Welch is native, he's Native American. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. We can write about ourselves? We can do this? And it just, it was like something, a door opened up for me and a seed was planted. Now, I came to writing later in life because when you grow up economically challenged, you know, you tend to do safe stuff. So I became a lawyer and a teacher and all that. But then later on in life, I came back to this book. And so the happy end to all this is, so James Welch, Winter in the Blood, is considered to be the greatest Native American novel. And a couple of reviewers, three or four, have said that my book, Winter Counts, is now in the Native American canon. And Craig Johnson, who is a writer that I just adore, he and I did an event together, and he looked me in the eye at the Zoom, through Zoom, and he's like, you have inherited the mantle from James Welch. And so I started crying right on screen, and I was embarrassed and humiliated. I'm like, oh, I need to be tough and everything. But that just meant so much to me, because to finally be able, you know, to in any way be compared and step in a small way to the shoes of James Welch. So that this for me is certainly the most important book that I've ever read. So thanks for letting me tell that story.
Awesome. Those were some great answers, y'all. All right. So I told you I'd have you out by 10 and I lied, I guess. I just want to thank you all for joining us today. If you want to stay for the viewer poll, you can, but I don't want to keep you too long. But I do want to let everyone watching know, whether you're watching live or you're watching the replay or you listen to the podcast, the websites and some social media links for all of our guests is in the description. So you can go and check out each of them and follow them and, you know, check out their books and their websites and everything. Yeah. So if you want to go, feel free. Say goodbye. If you want to talk about the viewer poll, we can do that too. Okay, cool.
say goodbye. I have kids, you know, teenagers, and they need me to go pick them up with their friends. But I just want to say thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to get to know everybody, and thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
All right, I just have to share the screen real quick, and David can head out. I can't see my screen right now. One second. There we go. Okay. So the question was, do you reread books? And I asked this question because I hear friends all the time talking about rereading some of their books. I know someone who like rereads the same series every single year. And I'm pretty much never, I'm comfortable saying never reread books. I've reread maybe two books in the past 10 years. Total. One of them was The Giver, because I was like, I need to reread this and see if it holds up. And the other was Joy McCullough's Blood, Water, Paint. Just because it was like, I felt like it was such a powerful book and I just needed to like take more time with it. And then I ended up writing a book article about my favorite quotes from it. So it turned out well. But so let's see what people said. We have 3.5 are with me, never. 22% said rarely, which I was surprised by. I thought more people, well, I guess that's not a big number, but anyway. 61.5% said they read a handful of books or some favorites. And then 13% said they reread a lot of books. So how about y'all? Where are you stand?
I voted for really reading a handful of favorites. I feel like this year has been, like I mentioned, a little bit less typical for me in terms of reading habits. but I usually, like you, I usually read a couple every year that, you know, meant a lot to me as a kid, especially if it's been a couple years since I've read it too. I like to see if they hold up, because I remember, especially with movies, I feel like loving some as a kid and then watching as an adult, and I'm like, oh, they couldn't act. But I didn't know that when I was a kid. But this year I kind of went back and I was like, what books did I really love as a kid that I don't actually own now? And I ended up ordering a bunch, mostly mass market paperbacks from the 90s that are out of print. So I had to kind of find them on eBay and stuff. But yeah, it's been really nice to reread and kind of take myself out of this year and kind of transport myself back to when I first read these books when I was a kid. And yeah.
Karen?
I'm with a handful of faves. I try not to reread the books from when I was like between like 11 and 16 for the same reason. There's always something problematic in them that I just go, oh God, so this is why I'm this way. Oh no. And so I kind of want to like keep them in my head as these, you know, great little things that I remember. But I will reread comfort books. I'll reread books that do something fantastic with craft. For example, I read N.K. Jemisin's N.K. Jemisin's Obelisk Gate, that series. I read that like about six times since it came out, because it just does such wonderful things with craft. And so I will read books that do something that I want to learn from. I'll reread some books that I will hunt around on eBay for books that I remember and that I don't think are in print. One of them was Illusion by Paula Volsky, which is like it's no longer in print, and it's a fantastical retelling of the French Revolution, and it's fun. And I'm glad I found it. So I will go hunt on eBay for those sometimes.
You guys are making me, I've not really thought to reread like the books that I loved, like when I was really like, I remember one book, Mrs. Pigglewiggle. I was obsessed with Mrs. Pigglewiggle as a child. Yeah. And I have not reread. I mean, I can't remember when I would have read it. I was obsessed with it as a kid.
They don't.
No, that's so depressing. Oh.
They're super ableist.
Oh no, that's very depressing. But you know, other books, maybe other books might hold up that I haven't really reread that I loved as a kid. But I do. I sometimes don't admit this because I know it's a divisive title for many people. But I used to reread almost yearly The Great Gatsby. I love The Great Gatsby, in part because I probably did not get it the first time I read it. And, you know, I was probably one of the, because I read it, you know, as a kid in some class I was supposed to read it for. And I'm sure that I liked it then more for the like, yay, parties and things than what it's really about. What I liked about rereading it, and I think this may have just been, I think I would like this rereading any book this many times, is, you know, I always still found something new when I read it. I wasn't really rereading it for comfort necessarily. I was rereading it and finding a new way to look at it. Like at this point I can have a full conversation about the, you know, potential that maybe Gatsby's black, but he's white passing. And like, I mean, it's just a completely different book and an experience to read now than it was when I first read it. I also just want to mention that in 2020, I reread Rachel Hawkins' Her Royal Highness, because I had an event with her. And so I was like, oh, I read this book like virtually in one sitting, but I don't remember everything. So I'm just going to skim it really quickly, just skim through to see what, and I just read the whole book again. And, and so I do definitely understand there's some books that you just, even though you know what happens, you just want to reread. They make you feel good.
Yeah, I wrote my senior thesis in college on the Great Gatsby and the cyclical nature of time, and it was very erudite. And but no, I love the writing. Lots of it. But anyway, the older I get, the less I reread. I think it's because my awareness of what's out there has expanded so exponentially that I'm just like, well, there's no time to read all of it. But I will say that sometimes I just get cravings for like one book in particular. Like when the pandemic started, the only thing I wanted to read, and this is really ridiculous, is the Doomsday book by Connie Willis, which is about like the plague. And it's a time travel novel where somebody goes back into like the plague times, and then there's this other pandemic going on in the same time, and like that was all I wanted to read. That was it. And I was like, you have really strange taste, Jess. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, based on the trending like Netflix selections right when the pandemic started, you weren't alone. Like a lot of people were watching pandemic movies and stuff. All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining me tonight. And I had a great time talking to all of you. And thank you in the comments. I have audiobook of the week, but I'm going to say goodbye to everyone first, and then I'll close out the show. And thank you all for joining us, and have a good night.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah,
thank you. Yeah. It's been really fun. Thank you all.
All right, I'm going to remove you one by one. So you're just going to drop like flies.
Bye.
And last one. There you go. All right. So just real quick, I wanted to talk about the audiobook of the week. I just realized I made the graphic like I usually do if there are two people and there's only me. So I'm going to move to the side so that it doesn't cover my face. So it's Grown by Tiffany D. Jackson, which is the first audiobook that I listened to after I was done with my Audie judging. And so it was the first book that I could talk about reading for 3 months. And it was like top of my list after I was free. And I just really enjoyed it. I thought it was really great. It's narrated by Janice Abbott Pratt, who has narrated some really great books. And it's about a 17-year-old aspiring singer who becomes involved in a situation similar to that detailed in the Surviving R. Kelly documentary. But the singer is murdered. And if you've ever read a Tiffany D. Jackson book, you know her books are really serious and deal with a lot of serious topics, and this is no different. It was at times not an easy read, but I thought it was really great. So that's the audiobook of the week. Now I can move back to center. All right, so if you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe right there so you don't miss another episode. Also tell your friends, because that is how they find out about shows like this. You can subscribe via email and by the link in the description. And you can also find the Patreon link in the description if you'd like to support the show. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. It means a lot to me that you are here month after month. Especially in times like these. The social media for all our guests are in the description, so follow everyone like Ebony just did. Thank you, Ebony. Oops, there it goes. And upcoming, we have Wednesday write-ins every week at 8 p.m., still doing that. And then exactly 1 week from now, I have Agent Chat Live with Claire Draper of the Bent Agency. So come back next Saturday at 9 p.m., and we'll all be talking to Claire. And thank you so much for watching, everyone. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, and we'll see you next time.